you need to start with a story that's pretty broad, something that anyone can relate to. And that's why I often will use stories from history. There are lots of ways that you can start broad and then become more focused and more precise in what you talk about.
I'm David Oatey, and this is The Power of Story and Science, a mix of content and conversations on how to bring your science to life through powerful presentations. When your topic is talking about science, and your sister is a scientist, having her on the show is not nepotism, it's a logical next step. In this episode, you'll hear from cell biologist Carol Oatey, PhD, as she talks about the story of her discovery of a new protein and about the important role stories have played in her teaching. Welcome to another episode of The Power of Story and Science. I'm your host, David Oatey. On this program, we have a combination of content and conversations. And today's episode is a conversation. And this is a conversation with one of my favorite scientists in the world. Full disclosure, she's my sister. I have asked Carol Oatey to join me on this podcast because, well, for a couple of reasons. One is, I find her work fascinating. She'll be able to tell you about that in more detail in just a moment. And I have enjoyed over the years many conversations with Carol about her research in cell biology. And I think that prompted a lot of my interest in science communication, because as you're going to learn, Carol is an excellent communicator about her science. Another reason that I wanted to have Carol on my program is because she's also an excellent teacher. And that tells me that she knows a thing or two about sharing the story of not only her work, but the work of many other scientists as well. So please join me in welcoming Carol Oatey. Carol, would you tell us a little bit about your background in the life sciences?
Well, David, thank you for having me. This is so much fun for me. So my background in the life sciences goes way back. I first got interested in biology in high school. I had a very, very talented high school biology teacher. And then I went on to take a whole variety of biology courses in college and got very interested in cell biology, and particularly in microscopy. I just loved looking at cells through the microscope. So I went on to pursue a PhD at UCLA in biology, and that's where I really did a deep dive into cell biology. And I got very interested in the fact that all the different types of cells in the body each have their own specialized shape, and that shape reflects their function. And yet they can change their shape very rapidly in response to different stimuli. So I became interested in the parts of the cell that give them their shape, the cytoskeleton. And it turns out that cells contain this network of filaments, which are very dynamic. So it's like your skeleton, only it can change in the blink of an eye. And so I went on to pursue that field of looking at how the cytoskeleton responds to change, how that allows cells to respond to challenges in their environment. And along the way, I started my own research lab at University of Virginia in Charlottesville. And then I moved my lab to the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill. And with a whole series of very talented graduate students and postdocs and technicians in my lab, we discovered a new protein that we named Paladin. And it turns out that this protein has a really important role in regulating the cytoskeletal elements of the cell. But also, and this was very surprising, this protein can transit between the cytoskeleton and the nucleus. And when it's in the nucleus, it can regulate gene expression. So it regulates which genes get turned on and turned off. This is a very unusual function for a protein to move between those compartments and to have that role. Once we realized that Paladin played a role in regulating which genes get turned on and off, that got us thinking about whether it could play a role in cancer, because, of course, cancer is all about deranged gene expression. And so we started looking at whether Paladin could be playing a role in breast cancer. We started there, and we began to accumulate some really exciting data that looked like perhaps it could contribute to breast cancer. Along the way, I got a phone call from a gastroenterologist at the University of Washington. Her name was Terry Brentnall. And she was working with a family, a group of patients who were famous in the literature for having the highest incidence of inherited pancreatic cancer of any family in the world. So this was a really tragic genetic inheritance of this family. And of course, pancreatic cancer is lethal. And this family had a particularly lethal form of the disease. Early onset, a large number of family members were affected. Often they died in their 40s. So it was a very, very sad disease. And Dr. Brentnall was doing everything she could to help this family. And one of the things she wanted to do was to identify the gene that carried a mutation that was causing the disease in this family. Long story short, we started collaborating, and it turns out that this family had a mutation in their Paladin gene. So that's really what got me interested then in pursuing the possibility that Paladin could be playing a role in other cancers besides breast cancer. So for about the last 10 years of my research career, I worked largely on Paladin's role in different types of cancer. And that was really fun for me. It put me into contact with pancreatic cancer surgeons. I had a wonderful collaborator, Dr. H.J. Kim, who's a very talented surgeon. And through him, I could get access to human patient samples that we could then study in the lab. So it was a lot of fun to go from very basic science, just trying to understand how cells maintain their shape, and taking that all the way to potentially to clinical applications.
Carol, I'm curious about something. Describe to me the sort of, I guess, the human element, in the sense that you as a researcher were aware that here was a disease that was having a horrible toll on this particular family, and yet at the same time it presented such an opportunity to get data that would be beneficial to your science. Is that a challenging tension to live in?
It is. I mean, every time that you have a sample, a specimen of human pancreatic cancer, you know, usually it's a little chunk of tissue that's frozen in a tube and you're going to work with it in the lab, you know, that represents a tragedy for that individual and for that person's family. You know, this was very clear to me working with Dr. Kim, the pancreatic cancer surgeon. Uh-huh. One of the things that was interesting about that collaboration, something I realized through that collaboration, is that scientists like myself are very much driven by curiosity. We are motivated every morning to get up and go to the lab because of intense curiosity about mm-hmm. the work that we do. The problem with that is that our curiosity can lead us off into funny little alleys and byways where there's something that we're interested in and we just want to know the answer, but it doesn't actually help the patient. And by working with Dr. Kim, one of the things he always did, if in lab meeting, the students and the postdocs and I would start talking about some experiment that we wanted to do, he would bring us back and say, yeah, okay, but tomorrow I might have a patient and I might have to look them in the eye and tell them that they have pancreatic cancer. How is this experiment going to help that patient? So he was constantly bringing us back to,
wow.
Yes, but what's the clinical value of this mm-hmm. of this question that you're asking? And that I found very helpful because otherwise studying pancreatic cancer can be extremely depressing. But if you always tell yourself that if you can help the patients even a little bit, there's very little that can be done to help the patients now. So anything that we could do to improve the situation would be great, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it would.
Your diagnosis, you know, if we could find the real holy grail would be to find some kind of a biomarker that would be present in blood or urine, something easily collected where we could screen people in the clinic to find
right.
out if they had cancer at a really early stage. So, you know, those kinds
and it
of... It hasn't happened yet. There have been many candidates, but it's hard to find one that will work for all types of people, right? All different races and ethnicities and genders. And, you know, it's been very hard to find one that's really effective for screening.
And yet the work you've done has created a foundation that others can build on and perhaps achieve that objective.
That's exactly right. And that is one of the things that, you know, you can see the glass half full or half empty. So one of the frustrating things about science is that you never, ever feel like you're done. You know, you make one discovery, you confirm it, you publish a paper, you feel good about that paper for a little while, but then you're immediately having to move on to, yes, but what's the next question? And what's the next question after that? So there's rarely a sense of completion. But the way I like to think of it is it's like putting together a jigsaw puzzle. And what you really want to do is just put in your piece of the puzzle. And then other people will put in their pieces around it. And eventually a clear picture will emerge.
You know, it's interesting, Carol. I just made a connection as you were talking about that. I talk a lot about using story to convey science, because story is that way of connecting with the reader, the listener, the audience, to use the broader term. And yet, we generally look for stories to have neat endings. Mm-hmm. And so much of science, and so much of the work that you do, the ending clearly isn't written yet. Do you think that gets in the way of scientists using story effectively? Do you think they shy away from that because it makes it seem too pat?
I think that's an interesting question. I think that every really effective scientific talk I've ever listened to ends with a slide that says, and here's the next step. Here's where we'd like to take this in the future. So I think it's a little bit like, you know, those old fashioned dramas where it ends and the hero's hanging on the cliff and then you wait. Right. So I think scientists like to, in their own minds, as they're listening to the talk, they're also probably thinking, if this were my project, what would I do next? So I think it's actually compelling to hear about an exciting project and then think about what the future might hold for that project.
Okay. That makes sense, because when I coach people on technical presentations, one of the things that I often coach people to do, urge people to do, that blows people away because it's so different from what is usually done, is I'll say, make sure that the Q&A is not the last thing people hear from you. Because so often you'll hear a technical presentation, and the presentation concludes, and then they take questions. And the last thing you hear the speaker say is, well, if there are no more questions, then I guess thank you very much. And I tell people that's not memorable. That doesn't maintain that connection with your audience to the very end. So one of the things I often encourage people to do is, I almost always tell people, save something, some concluding remarks, not conclusion, which has a specific meaning in a technical presentation, but concluding remarks for after the Q&A. And one of the sources of material to mine, I think, for that, those concluding remarks can be, let me suggest some avenues I see here for future research that will build on what we've done. Because that way you're not introducing new information so much.
Right. I think that's really good advice. I think often the very last thing that a researcher says during the Q&A is, well, I don't know. That's where the questions take you, right? Questions take you right up to the point of having to say, well, we haven't done that experiment yet. You know, I showed you all the data we have. And we haven't done that experiment. That sounds like a great experiment, but I don't know the answer to your question, right? Not really how you want to leave your audience.
So instead of saying, I don't know, you might just say, that sounds like a promising avenue for future research.
Right.
So let's talk about collaborating on that.
Right. Can I get the number?
That's right. Gosh, as an interviewer, I should always have another question ready, right? And I had something in mind, and then all of a sudden it was displaced by another thought. But Carol, one of the things I'd like to hear about from you is a little bit more about your teaching, because you had not only a research role, and to be clear, it's been a little while since you stopped doing that research, right? You shut down that lab.
Right.
About how long ago?
I think it was 4 or 5 years ago.
Okay.
I don't really think of myself as totally having left research because I continue to collaborate, but I don't have my own lab. But I help other people continue on with the work that I started, which is a lot of fun for me.
I know what it was. I may come back to a question about your research in a minute. But all along, you've also had a teaching responsibility at UNC.
Right.
And that continues. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, you know, that's been interesting, too. I will, full disclosure, I've always taught. Ever since I've had a faculty position, I've had a research lab, and I've had teaching responsibilities. I haven't always enjoyed it as much as I do now.
Oh.
And I think that's because for many years, teaching was the thing I had to do, and research was the thing I got to do.
Oh,
you know, they needed me to be in the classroom because, you know, every department has teaching responsibilities. I often felt that I was I felt like an imposter in the classroom. I hadn't had a lot of training in how to be an effective educator, and I never felt that I did it very well. And then what happened was that as time went by, I got to know more and more people in the School of Medicine at UNC who were really good teachers. And I just started paying really close attention to what they did that was effective. And I found that I could borrow ideas from them. You know, educators tend to be a very generous group of people. And they're happy to coach you. And they're happy to let you practice your lectures and then give you comments. And so once I sort of got in with that group of faculty who were really dedicated to education, I felt like I was stepping up my own game. And then a very interesting thing happened. So about 10 years ago, the chair of my department left, and I was asked to serve as interim chair. And so through that service, which I did for 3 years, I got to know people at the next leadership level, so the deans of the School of Medicine. And I was tapped to serve on a task force that was tasked with given the job of basically completely restructuring the curriculum for the medical students at UNC.
Hmm.
And so once I got really involved in thinking about what makes a good curriculum, how can we improve our curriculum, that brought me even further into the educational mission in a completely different way than I'd ever been involved before. And I became part of the team that was creating new courses in this new curriculum. And that was a whole new challenge. And so I started by creating a new course that was for second year medical students. It's in reproductive medicine. And then I got involved in a course for first year medical students when they first come to medical school, that completely different challenges with brand new medical students. Then because I was involved in the medical school's new curriculum, I was also invited to go across the street and to help create a new curriculum in the UNC Eshelman School of Pharmacy. So I don't know if you're very familiar with our School of Pharmacy at UNC. We have the top-ranked program in the country for PharmDs. So these are students who, it's a four-year doctoral program. Mm-hmm. They're doctors of pharmacy when they finish. They have a really important role in the clinic. And we have terrific pharmacy students at UNC. And I was invited to help create a new course for the brand new curriculum that they were rolling out. So getting involved in education from that perspective, curriculum reform, working with these really highly selected, really brilliant young professionals in the health sciences, that was a whole new challenge for me. And then UNC created a brand new program for physician's assistants. So for many years, we had been the only medical school in the state of North Carolina that didn't have a PA program. And a few years ago, they created a new one. And I was not involved in creating that curriculum, but I was involved in teaching those students. So I had no administrative responsibilities. I just showed up and taught, which was fun. And then our department, which is cell biology and physiology, worked together with other departments to create an interdepartmental curriculum in cell biology and physiology. And I was involved in creating, launching a new course in that curriculum. So it's given me an opportunity to work with people who I think are the most talented educators across multiple schools at UNC. It's been a lot of fun, and I've learned so much from them.
I loved how you told that story in a way that built, you know, one thing on another, and then this happened, and the excitement that I could see in how that journey took you through learning more about not just curriculum, but about yourself as a teacher. I'd like to pick up on that when we come back from a short break. This is The Power of Story and Science. I'm David Odie, and my guest today is my sister, Carol Odie, and we'll be right back. You are a knowledgeable expert, and you want your expertise to make a difference to your audience, but you can't see them and gauge their reactions. Therefore, you need new tools for engaging that unseen audience. Hi, I'm David Odie, offering you a way to pick up those tools. In my new self-paced online course, you will discover three ways to improve your story, one fascinating tool for hooking your audience's attention, and eight details in your physical environment that will set you apart from other virtual presenters. Today's technical presentations are going virtual, and that means you can reach a wider audience as long as you understand how to serve that audience. So join me for the online course, Own the Virtual Stage. Confidently connect with an unseen audience. Just go to ownthevirtualstage.com for details. And we're back. This is The Power of Story and Science. I'm your host, David Odie, and my esteemed guest on today's program is my sister, my favorite scientist in the world, Carol Odie, from whom I've learned so much about the life sciences, because my background is in the physical sciences with physics and engineering. And Carol, I remember you telling me once, I don't know that we have time to go into all the detail on this, about your full characterization of that new protein you discovered that you named Paladin. Mm-hmm. But one of the things I remember you telling me about that is that took a very long time. How many years was it?
Well, from the time I first realized that it was something new until mm-hmm. the time when we first published it was 7 years. I think 7 years.
Mm-hmm. That's what I was thinking, was that it was 7 or 8 years, something mm-hmm. like that.
One of the reasons why it took so long is because if you're working on a protein that's well characterized, well known, you can order off the shelf tools to help you study that protein. But when you're studying something brand new, you have to create all your own tools. Mm-hmm. So it took a while, but it was a labor of love. It was always a very interesting story from the beginning.
But if you were to start, if you or someone with your background were to start that process today, where you realize here's something new, we need to figure out what it is, those tools will have changed in the interim, right? Wouldn't that be a much faster process today than it was when you started on it?
Oh, you're so right, David. So one thing, just to put this in perspective, at the time that we started working on Paladin, the human genome had not yet been fully sequenced. And the mouse genome had not yet been fully sequenced. So now with so much sequence available and so many great experimental tools for silencing genes, that we have great tools for that now. Silencing genes in cells, silencing
the
genes
now.
You can ascertain the function of a novel gene or a novel protein, a gene product, much faster now than when we were first working on this.
Hmm. Obviously science is all about change. It's about changing the state of our knowledge about something. And it's changed so much in the time that you were doing your research. It's just fascinating to me. I've used that example of the story, sort of the unfinished story of what mm-hmm. is our knowledge of Paladin going to do for us clinically as an example in some of my talks of what do you do when the final chapter of the story is not yet unfolded. And one way to approach that would be to say, you know, what if? What right. if someone were to build on the research that you and your collaborators, your many collaborators, have done and find a way to detect this mutation in Paladin, let's say, in a non-invasive way before there was a clinical reason to look for it, right? Because by that time with pancreas cancer, it's usually too late, right?
Right.
Yeah. That whole what if, that's what I would think it would inspire a lot of people to want to do further research based on what you've done.
Right. And, you know, for me, I'm approaching retirement. I plan to go on to phased retirement in July. So that means I'll be working half-time for probably about 3 years. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for me, that process of deciding that it was okay to think about retirement, a lot of it had to do with really sort of keeping an eye on the literature. And when I began to see that labs, people I'd never heard of, people who did not know me and had never heard me give a talk or probably read any of my papers, but they were getting pulled into the Paladin field because of their own interests. And I had this realization that definitely the field will continue. You know, the baton has been passed. People are going to continue to study this protein. So that made it okay for me to start thinking about retirement.
Oh, that must be satisfying.
It is.
And so in the last few years, since you haven't had your own lab, but still, as you say, have been collaborating, you've also been doing this teaching, and you've won awards for your teaching.
Yeah, that's been a lot of fun.
You've been very modest about that, but tell our audience a little bit about how you've been recognized for the quality of your instruction in the classroom.
Well, it's kind of you to bring that up, David. So I told you that I was invited to create a new course in the new curriculum that they rolled out in the Eshelman School of Pharmacy. And that course was in pathophysiology. And it's one of the first courses that the first year PharmD students take. And you can understand how foundational that is for future pharmacists. First, they have to understand the disease process. And we started, as we were creating the course, we started with a list of what are the most common diseases and disorders that affect the citizens of North Carolina. And that was sort of our go-to list for structuring this course. And so we teach about the pathophysiology of those diseases. And then as the students continue on in their training, they're going to learn the therapies, right? How do you treat these very common diseases? So that was a fun course to create, and it was a really fun group of students to interact with. And so I taught that course for 5 years, and then just last year I decided to hand it off to others in the School of Pharmacy. But during those 5 years, I was voted Instructor of the Year by the first year students 3 times, which was really
three out of five.
that was wonderful.
Congratulations for that.
And thank you. And I felt like I learned a lot from those students. And there's one example I'd like to share with you, if I may.
Oh, please do.
So when one is teaching to health science students, you often like to use patient cases as stories, right?
That makes sense.
And so typically what you might do is teach about a disease and, you know, lecture for a while, and then you'll turn to a patient case and you'll describe the patient and, you know, you'll give a little bit of background about the individual and maybe their medical history and their chief complaint and their vital signs and what showed up in the physical exam. And then you'll ask the students to talk among themselves a little bit and come up with a diagnosis. And there might be some questions for the students. In one case, I was teaching the students about type 1 diabetes. And so I described a case where an older gentleman, he's had diabetes for a while. He has an infection in his foot. And so he's had a fever. He's not feeling well. And his wife ends up taking him to the emergency department because she thinks he's become disoriented. So he's had a change in mental status. And then there's some other things in the physical exam that should clue the students in to the fact that this patient is having an episode of diabetic ketoacidosis. It's a very serious complication that can happen when someone who has type 1 diabetes has some kind of physiological stress, like an infection.
Ah.
Okay, so I used this case as a teaching tool for years. It was a very good case. There were a lot of questions that we could follow up with. One day, one of my students asked if she could speak with me after class. And she told me that she'd noticed that in every case that I used where someone's partner took them to the emergency department or someone's partner gave information to the physician, it was always heterosexual couples.
Mm.
And she asked me, is there any reason why it couldn't have been a same-sex partner who took the gentleman to the emergency department? You know, couldn't you just change the cases a little bit? And I realized that she was absolutely right. And it, you know, it took a student to point out to me that making the cases diverse in that way was just another way of making the classroom a welcoming, safe space for all of the students. And so I really made an effort after that to go through all of the cases that I used for teaching and make sure that I was representing all the types of patients, right?
All the types of patients. Wow. What? How brave of that student to come and point that out to you.
I know. It was brave of her, and I felt like she really helped me improve my teaching. She graduated several years ago, and we're still in touch. I'm very grateful to her.
Oh, that's nice. That's wonderful. So these stories of cases were a key to your success as an instructor, I would imagine.
I think that that is one really wonderful way to help make the information memorable to the students.
Right.
I'll give you another example. And I'm not an MD, so I don't see patients. So when I come up with these cases, sometimes I'm drawing on my experience with friends or colleagues or family members. And so in one instance, I tell the story of someone who I actually knew. And of course, I changed the details, for patient privacy reasons. This was a colleague, but I tell the story of a very accomplished physician who gets a special recognition that allows him to go and tour hospitals abroad. And he takes his family with him. And so while he's touring these hospitals and going out to eat every night with different groups of colleagues, people who are celebrating his accomplishments, this is a special award for him.
Mm-hmm.
He starts experiencing abdominal pain.
Oh.
And he's a physician, so he self-diagnoses this as, well, he's been staying up late and having rich meals and lots of wine, and so maybe he's having acid reflux, esophageal reflux.
Mm-hmm.
So, after 3 days of this, he actually collapses and dies.
Oh.
And autopsy reveals that he has a ruptured abdominal aorta.
Oh.
It's a very tragic story. I mean, it was a tragic loss in real life, of course, but it's also a very memorable story. And it can be used to illustrate a number of really important points, one of which is that pain, when you feel pain in your internal organs, it's often not very well localized. Now,
true.
I can stand up and lecture on that, and I can say, visceral pain is difficult to localize. Your patients won't always be able to tell you exactly where the pain is. I can tell students that.
Mm-hmm.
And I do.
And you do, I'm sure.
But if you present them with this case, and, of course, I don't tell them the end right away. I present them with his symptoms and what do you think this is? And they all think it's esophageal reflux, right?
Right.
And then I tell them the end of the story and I show them a slide that shows where the aorta is and how close it is to the esophagus.
Right.
We talk about how pain from the viscera is difficult to localize. And I imagine they will always remember that, because it's such a sad and memorable story.
It is a sad story and a memorable one, as you say. And that really is much of the point of using stories, isn't it? Is to make those points memorable and make it something that people can visualize.
Right.
Yeah. And I assume you have some happier stories as well.
I do have happy stories. something I rely on a lot, and this is something I learned from watching my colleagues, I tell stories from history a lot. There are wonderful stories that you can find in human history. One that I have a colleague who is an OB-GYN surgeon, Dr. Jennifer Howell, and she tells a very interesting story about shoulder dystocia.
Never heard of that.
Go into the classroom and you say, okay, students, today we're going to talk about shoulder dystocia. You can just imagine the eyes rolling, right?
Yeah.
But it turns out shoulder dystocia is something that can happen if a baby is born in a breech position.
Okay.
And the body comes out, but the little arms get caught. And so there can be stretching, extreme stretching at the shoulder, right at the shoulder joint.
Okay.
Well, inside your shoulder, sort of right inside your armpit, there are a bunch of really important nerves called the brachial plexus. And the nerves from the brachial plexus innervate all the muscles of the arm and the hand.
Okay.
And they also give you sensation. So really important nerves. So if an infant experiences shoulder dystocia, it can stretch the brachial plexus and damage those nerves.
Oh.
And it can result in permanent muscle weakness in that arm.
Okay.
In the affected limb. Okay, it turns out that shoulder dystocia may have been one of the leading causes of World War I.
Really?
Yes.
Okay, make that connection for me.
So look up the images of Kaiser Wilhelm. Kaiser Wilhelm suffered shoulder dystocia when he was born. It was a difficult delivery. And his left arm was noticeably shorter than his right arm. And he had sort of a clawed form to his hand. And he tried to hide it. He was clearly very self-conscious about it. He always wore a glove. He often posed in pictures with his arm bent so that you couldn't tell that it was shorter than the other arm. And historians believe that this feeling of self-consciousness that he had and a fear of being perceived as weak may have really shaped his personality and led him to overcompensate for this, you know, with this fear of being perceived as weak, to be more aggressive in terms of, you know, leading his country into war. And then you think about how much World War I completely reshaped Europe. I mean, you know, countries have had their borders totally redrawn as a result of war. And so many millions of soldiers died from so many countries. And it all comes back to shoulder dystocia.
Shoulder dystocia. Who would have thought?
Who would have
thought? Okay.
That's not a happy story.
Not a particularly happy story, but a fascinating one.
The point is that you can find a lot of fun stories by delving into history.
Wow. Okay. Interesting stories. Interesting stories.
Okay, let me tell you a more fun
way. We'll close with a fun story.
Okay. This is another thing that Jennifer Howell does. So when she creates patient cases, she often uses literature to inspire her cases.
Okay.
And so it's a little bit, you know, the concept of Easter eggs, hiding Easter eggs.
In a story or in a program or.
Exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. She does that in her cases. So just to give you an example. So this case is a 45-year-old woman who's concerned about a family history of breast cancer. Her first name is Blanche. She goes to see her physician in her hometown of New Orleans. She has a younger sister named Stella. Both of them are wondering at what age should they begin to have mammograms, given their family history. So it's really a case just to get you thinking about the recommendations for mammograms in people with a family history of breast cancer. But, you know, Blanche, Stella, New Orleans. So you're hoping that, you know, the students are going, wait, is this a streetcar named Desire? Right? It's just a fun way. I mean, if you're going to have a case anyway.
Right.
Why not hide some Easter eggs in there?
Why not? Why not get people's imagination going? As long as it's not.
Just get them thinking.
As long as it's not too distracting, that they're trying to remember the name of some other character from A Streetcar Named Desire. Oh, it sounds like you and your colleagues have some fascinating ways of using stories to make science really come alive for people.
And well, we enjoy teaching these students. These are fantastic students at UNC.
I'm sure you do. You and I could keep talking about this for a much longer time. I'm going to have to respect the time here and draw our program to a close. Keeping in mind that this is really a story that's intended for people to give scientific or engineering or other kinds of technical presentations, and that I focus a lot on, as you have been for the last little while, on stories, is there one key insight to making a story memorable that you'd like to share by way of wrapping us up?
I think what you want to do when you tell stories is to invite people in. And I find that particularly when you're giving a talk to a really diverse audience where they're not already invested in exactly the subject that you're going to talk about, you need to start with a story that's pretty broad, something that anyone can relate to. And that's why I often will use stories from history. I mean, everyone finds World War I interesting, right? There are lots of ways that you can start broad and then become once you've got everyone invested, then become more focused and more precise in what you talk about.
Start broad and mm-hmm. then come down to the very specific. That sounds like excellent advice. Carol, we're going to have to wrap this up. Now that people have heard about your work and the fact that you still offer some opportunities for collaboration, how can someone get in touch with you to start a conversation with you?
Oh, they'd always be welcome to email me. So right now I'm still at UNC, and so they can use my UNC email address, which is carol_ote@med.unc.edu.
carol_ote, for those who are listening and don't see it on the screen, at, again?
medmed.unc.edu.
All right. Well, and I hope that may lead to some very fruitful collaborations as well. Thank you so much for taking the time to be on my show. I always enjoy our conversations, and I believe that my audience will have enjoyed this one as well. For anyone who wants to follow up with me, perhaps with suggestions for future guests, for interviews on this program, or any questions you might have about the content, the easiest way to do that is to go to storyandscience.com. Storyandscience.com will take you to the home page of this program. From there, you can explore my website and even find the button that says schedule consultation, which will allow you to pick 15 minutes on your calendar and mine for a Zoom call if you'd like to have a conversation. This is David Ote, The Power of Story and Science. Thank you for being a part of this community. This has been The Power of Story and Science. If you like what you heard, please tell a friend, leave us a review, or so that you don't miss anything, subscribe at Podbean or wherever you like to get your podcasts. This program is a production of Speaking of Solutions, LLC. Theme music by Kevin Lufkin. I'm David Ote. Thanks for listening.